Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 157 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
On today's show, owner of La New Yorkina, a Mexican sweets company, and she is also the co-owner of Dough Donuts, Fanny Gerson. Welcome to The Morning After.
Thank you.
Later in the show, we'll give Fanny una prueba, The Morning After quiz.
What does that mean?
It means a quiz, right?
A test.
Una prueba.
Yeah. But first, hey, Sari, was there some food news this week?
Unfortunately, yes.
And Fanny, I would love to hear your opinion about all of the food.
Well, okay. I think we'll all have something to say. The headline for this one is just, this restaurant is the worst.
Okay.
Oh. shockingly from Pakistan.
Oh, God.
Wah, wah. There is a restaurant that is using that old trope, women are only good for making men a sandwich, as their marketing ploy, I guess. The restaurant is called Table 5. Each sandwich is named after a celebrity who is notorious for being like a wife beater. So sandwiches are named after Charlie Sheen, Chris Brown, Sean Penn, Bill Cosby, and Mike Tyson. And so their whole marketing is based on haha funny jokes, like, which are like famous, or which are quotes from like famous people. I'll give you some examples. This is from the ever famous notorious Eminem. I don't hate women, they just sometimes refuse to make me sandwiches. Or behind,
I actually don't have words.
I know. Behind every successful man is a woman who made sandwiches for him. That was Voltaire. So that is their like marketing scheme, I guess. And BuzzFeed was the one that reported the story. They reached out, and then I guess a representative said, "Hey, it's all in good fun. It's just jokes, and that's what we truly believe in. This whole rapist stuff was never our intention." So,
wow.
I don't know. Even for Pakistan, man.
Oh, my God. So are women actually working there?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Who's the actual owner?
Just like some guy.
Some wife beater.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Some guy who thinks that's funny.
Like an ode to his idols.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, hey. Okay.
This is a sense of humor, apparently.
You know, maybe the women are making the sandwiches, but they can poison them, too. Right?
True.
It's our call to actions. Women, poison these sandwiches. Or poison the people eating the sandwiches, rather.
Man, Sarah, that brought me down a little bit.
I know. I'm sorry.
Do you have anything to bring us back up?
Sure. Let's talk about Starbucks' war on Christmas.
Okay, great.
Isn't that fun?
That is.
So you guys have probably heard about this by now. It's actually been in the news a lot. A lot of people are very upset with Starbucks for waging war on Christmas. And they are doing this by having their Christmas, or rather their holiday cups, being just kind of plain red with like the Starbucks hippie lady, whoever that woman is. As the decoration, as opposed to like Merry Christmas or even, God forbid, a snowflake. So yeah. So,
I mean, I was gonna say, as I am a non-Jew, but you both have Jewness.
Totally.
Is a snowflake very offensive? Does that feel like? Are you like, oh, this is like Jesus on a cup?
Are you siding with Starbucks?
No, I'm just asking. Like, I could care less about this. I don't even go to Starbucks. I think a red cup symbolizes holiday season to me.
Well, that's what Starbucks is saying.
No, so I'm just like literally asking you, is this like, is this
a
snowflake?
A snowflake does not offend me. No.
Okay. No.
I'm also cool with just a red cup. But there's a lot of evangelicals in particular who are taking to social media to rant about this supposed war on Christmas. This one guy in particular, his name is Josh Feuerstein. I'm sorry, does that not sound like really Jewish to anybody else? He's like a born again Christian. Just like, if anyone's out there, maybe you want to Google that. So he went online and like made this video. It's like this Facebook Joshua Feuerstein made a video.
Joshy.
Good old Joshy from the neighborhood. Like ranting about it. And I guess people or the baristas or whoever at Starbucks are not supposed to say like Merry Christmas or whatever. So he has found a way to trick them because they ask your name to like write on the cup. So he said, my name is Merry Christmas. So when his coffee was ready, they were like, Merry Christmas. And he was like, ha ha, I made you say Merry Christmas. So he's encouraging everyone out there to tell their Starbucks barista their name is Merry Christmas. So
can
they
I just
will
say
be.
There's way too many people with too much time in their hands.
Yes, yes, you can, Fanny. Yes, you can. Do you want to know how many people? 150,000 people who have liked that video so far. You all have too much time on your hand. Okay, here's something
again,
funny.
I'm kind of speechless.
I know, I know. Okay, back to the Middle East. So apparently there's a law in Saudi Arabia that bans alcohol. I didn't know this. Did you guys know this?
I did know that.
I did know that.
Okay, cool. I'm just really uneducated. Thanks. No alcohol whatsoever, but people obviously try and get around this law. So an individual, one guy, had a very creative plan to sneak about 48,000 cans of Pepsi into Saudi Arabia by disguising them. Oh, I'm sorry, 48,000 cans of Heineken disguised as Pepsi. So during like a routine just check as he's crossing the border, they're like, let me see your truck. And they were like, those are stickers that say Pepsi. So foiled! but it's kind of a big deal because he could actually go to prison for it.
I'm sure he will go to prison.
He probably will. Saudi Arabia, not known for their super lax laws.
Well, I'm actually surprised that caffeine's allowed.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I'm just putting it out there, you know, you can't have alcohol. Caffeine's a stimulant, right? You know, right?
No. I mean, sure, but you're opening a whole can of worms there.
I guess they're not Mormon in Saudi Arabia that I know of.
No, and they might be waging a war on Christmas.
I'm sure they are.
We'll look into
everyone
that.
Else is.
Yes,
if they're not saying Merry Christmas at the border check, then they are.
We're going to take a break here on the morning after. We're going to come back with Fanny Gerson.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State-grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arriving to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer. And trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit christmastreesny.org.
And we're back here on The Morning After. From Mexico City to New York City, Fanny Gerson of Dough and La Newyorkina is changing the way we think about the sweet side of Mexican cuisine. Welcome to The Morning After, Fanny.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to know why did you choose to bring kind of the sweet side of Mexican cuisine to New York City and work with that versus the savory side?
Well, I think it all started basically because I wanted to. It was sort of by chance, you know. But there was a part of it that was really developed after I wrote my first cookbook, My Sweet Mexico. I spent a whole year traveling around Mexico, documenting, trying to not necessarily rescue, but really to give continuity to a lot of the traditions. And I basically ended up writing the book that I kept looking for, you know, so that really inspired me to come back to New York and wanting to continue to share the sweets. But also it was because I was very nostalgic. In the same way that I wanted to find that book, I wanted to find those treats, and I just wanted to share that because there's a lot of people doing a lot of things in the savory side, and there's a lot more to be said, written, shared, etc. But nobody is really doing it with the sweet side, and that's such an important part of the culture as well.
Is that something you discovered when you were in Mexico? Because I read that you went to CIA and you didn't study pastry there. You were doing savory food.
Yes. So I studied before the CIA, went to school in Mexico. My parents did not want me to study cooking. And, you know, they said, well, why don't you go to this school in Mexico, like this, you know, this little school for 2 years. And if you still want to go, but they thought I was just going to get out of my system and going to do something else. Funnily enough, I always say it's not like they wanted me to study law or engineering or anything like that. They wanted me to study art.
Wow. Another very reliable career choice.
Exactly, exactly. I said, this is my art, you know. So, but I'm very glad that I had to do that, actually, because I learned a lot about Mexican food. And at the CIA, I think Mexican food was mixed in with, you know, South American food in one day. So, but I was originally going to go to the pastry program. And when I did my internship in Mexico, I was at the Four Seasons Hotel. And the food and beverage manager, who used to be the executive chef at the Ritz-Carlton in Chicago, called me in one day and said, well, what? So I hear you're doing the baking and pastry program. Why? You know, and I'm like,
oh, hi.
Hi. Nice to meet you. And so I said, well, because I want to specialize in pastry. And he said, how can you specialize without having a solid foundation? And he pretty much like scolded me, you know. And he just gave me advice. And he said, you know, honestly, the school in Mexico is a great introduction, but it's not a solid foundation. You're much better off, you know, getting a really good solid foundation somewhere else. Whether it's at the CIA or the Cordon Bleu on something, and then focus on whatever you want to focus. But if you go straight into baking and pastry, you're going to limit yourself. And what if one day you wake up and you don't want to do another pie or another cookie or anything else? So I took his advice. And I think it was great advice, yeah. Because I learned to do a lot of things that I'm happy I know how to do.
Yeah.
But in the same token, it has taken me a longer route to get, you know, to understand a lot of things that in the pastry world.
Is that also why you have in the past called yourself an anti-pastry chef?
Yes, I think so.
You knew that would creep up on you.
Yes, I think I said it once and then it's just...
It's haunting
me. But it's true. I mean, most pastry chefs...
What does that
chefs,
even mean?
Well, for me, most pastry chefs that I know, you know, friends and colleagues, they're morning persons, and I'm definitely not. You know, they're very methodical. They're very, you know, how you say...
Precise.
So it's more of a personality
precise.
Type.
It's
is
more
what
of
you're
a
talking.
Personality okay. type, and I am none of those things at all. Like, I'm... You know, I'm a multitasker and I'm thinking, and even the way that I approach a recipe, like when I have to actually do a recipe, it's very difficult for me to remember that, you know, that I actually have to write down all the little steps so that I remember how to trace back and be able to replicate it. But that's just the way that I am in general. Yeah. When I moved to New York, my mother gave me a book called Organizing Your Life. And I said...
Subtle.
Yeah, exactly. I said, Mom, you know, you could just tell me. And the first page, which was the only one I read, talked about how, you know, there's different ways that people organize themselves. So if, you know, there's the kind of person that, let's say you have a desk... And there's piles and piles, and not even the person whose desk it belongs to knows how to find a piece of paper. But there's other people that, you know, maybe it's a mess, but you kind of have a general idea. It's just not organized for the world. So he says, so you're not completely disorganized. There's, you know, some kind of order to your disorder.
Method to your madness.
So I was like, oh, I fall in that category. I don't need to read this book.
Perfect. So tell me about La New Yorkina.
So La New Yorkina is sort of my baby. So La New Yorkina, like I said, started out of a desire to continue to share the sweetness of Mexico. so to speak. And I didn't, you know, it started out with paletas, which are Mexican ice pops. But I knew from the very beginning I wanted to do more. So even in like the logo, it says Mexican ice and sweets. Mm-hmm. I just wanted that to leave open. And so it's just a company devoted to try to make the best Mexican frozen treats and sweets. And I have several carts in the city, and I do ice cream now. I do it mainly wholesale, and I'm working on, you know, trying to open a brick and mortar next year, looking for funding.
Yeah, if anybody's interested.
At the moment. But with the plans to open early summer, late spring next year, and it's very exciting. We're also doing some packaging, like some boxes of mini paletitas for supermarkets, but not like a nationwide thing. That's a whole other business.
Yeah.
You know, it's more sort of visibility, and it's very exciting. So there's a lot of moving parts. And then we have an online store where we do our candies. And so it's just a lot of different pieces. And then right now I'm in the middle of researching and writing my next cookbook, which is about the ice creams of Mexico. So it's very nice because I get to do that, but at the same time, my wheels are turning about, you know, the store itself.
That sounds like the most fun cookbook to ever research.
It's been amazing. It's been amazing. Yes.
So let's talk about the flavors a little bit that you hone on, because every time I, you know, come across La Neoyorquina, it's like the flavors. They're very unusual and creative, and they really seem to be redolent of the flavors of Mexico. Like, what are your kind of like staple go-to ingredients?
Well, you know, you always have to have, like one of our most popular flavors is the mango chili, you know, and that we've had since day one, and we have to have it. And we always have the salted chili seasoning on the cart, so you can put it on there. But really, the amount of flavors that we can do are just endless. But there's a lot of flavors that have chili and or sour notes, or, you know, and some of them have chunks and some are solid. And so there isn't one, you know, word or one type to describe. I would say for the most part, though, I do water-based, and then I do some dairy-based. I just happen to like more the water-based ones, but we do cream ones. And actually, we're already testing recipes for next year, because we're anticipating, you know, a very big year, and we're going to be very busy producing, that we won't have a lot of time to test recipes. So we just you know, tested 30 different flavors, and
all new.
Did
you have some favorites?
Flavors. Yeah, we have a creamy mezcal with candied figs. That's a favorite. Another creamy one.
Jack, did you hear that?
Yeah, sorry. I was eating donuts.
Creamy mezcal.
Another creamy one is based out of this candy called guayabate, which is one of my favorites, and it's basically a guava paste with pecans and cajeta, which is goat's milk caramel. So wow. That into a paleta. And then, you know, we have some savory ones. There's one, there's a juice. It sounds like it's not, there's nothing special about it, but I just, it really takes me back home. There's this juice called Oasis. And it's
it must be a blend.
It's a blend. Yes, yeah, definitely a
the
blend.
Oasis fruit.
And it's mango, orange, and strawberry. And I just, it's very simple, but, you know, one of those things that you just haven't. And also a flan paleta.
Ooh, oh, my God.
I'm really excited about the flan paleta.
So the paletas that you're doing in New York, are those reminiscent of what you see in Mexico? Or is it a much more elaborate version?
I would say, you know, some of them are very reminiscent. Just try to do the best version of what I can do. I mean, there's a lot of flavors I can't do, unfortunately, because we can't get the fruit here. So, but with time, that's been getting better and better, because, you know, you see an expansion in the imports and all of that. So there's some, you know, like the hibiscus, you're going to find pretty much the way you find it there, or the tamarind, you know, so those kinds of fruits. But then there's other, and in the very beginning, I really wanted to do flavors that you would just find in Mexico. I was very hesitant to do anything else. I was like, I'm going to stand on my ground. And then I thought, why am I being so stubborn? Because I said, in Mexico, part of the philosophy is always to take advantage of your surroundings. And I said, it's silly not to take advantage of the amazing fruit that abounds here in the summer, you know, the stone fruit that we just don't have in Mexico, a lot of the berries. So I said, as long as there's an element that takes you back to Mexico, so there's other things that you wouldn't find there that maybe are more, you know, either contemporary or sophisticated or however you want to say. Like I did, one of my favorites is the sour cream paleta with apricots that are roasted with piloncillo, cinnamon, and guajillo chili. So you wouldn't find that.
So many layers
there. Yeah.
But that is one fancy popsicle.
It is a fancy popsicle. And then, you know, there's others that I do that are filled. And then one, when we were tasting 2 days ago, I was thinking, you know, one of the girls that rents in my kitchen this space, she's also from Mexico. And do you know what chamoy is? So chamoy is this pickled plum juice. You also have it in the Japanese use it.
Umeboshi.
Yeah. So it's a, you know, it's pickled, it's salty, it's sweet. And I say, this paleta is not for everyone, but for those of us who love it. And she said, oh, you know what? In the area of Mexico where she's from, you know, it's like they have whole places, establishments dedicated to things made with chamoy. Hmm. She said, you should put, you know, tamarind candy in it. You know, there was this particular one made from this little fruit called tejocotes. And I was like, yes, we should totally do that. I've never had that in a paleta. So now we're gonna do that. So that's going to be like the junkie, the hangover paleta.
Oh. I want to know, what is it like working with purveyors in Mexico? Because you want to get these specific ingredients. Is it, you've said it's a challenge to get certain fruits and things like that.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, there's a lot of you know, purveyors and distributors of Mexican produce, which is good. But then I continue to try to, you know, like I source our chocolate. It's, you know, it's from Oaxaca. So there's a lot of challenges in timing. There's another woman that makes another chocolate that I buy in another state. And it's always the logistical part is the challenge. And then there's this guy who's trying to get me my favorite fruit, soursop, which is guanabana. Have you had it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
okay. So good.
You have to go to Mexico just to have this. I describe it kind of the flavor between like a lychee and a pear, but meaty. Oh, it's so good. So I've been trying to get that, and you know, and he's like, well, what's the demand going to be? I said, I don't know. He's like, how do you know not know the demand? I need to know to quote you. Mm-hmm. I said, because I've never had it. So I don't know how people, I said, I want it because I love it, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't know. I hope.
You demand it.
Yes, I demand it. So I said, I will consume a lot of those things. But, you know, and then sometimes even like the Mexican purveyors have a lot of, you know, so the hibiscus, sometimes even though the bag says it's from Mexico, and it could be from Mexico, it turns out it's from China. And you can tell because of the way it tastes, but you can't, not when you see it. It's mm-hmm. only until you prepare it. Mm. But that's a whole other political
issue. Yeah. I mean, speaking of like political, what's going on with the limes?
The limes. Well, the limes, you know, last year, last year they also went up in price like four times as much. And, you know, it's.
Why don't you just like give a quick backstory for those listeners who weren't aware of what was happening?
So, you know, a lot of the areas where the limes grow were sort of occupied by people related to the drug
cartel
cartels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they charge a certain fee to be able to continue to do with their business, you know, kind of like a mafia. And so the price of limes, and it may seem the price of limes and corn you know, and tortillas are very important in Mexico. So, you know, for one box of lime, just to have a reference, you know, I would usually get it, you know, for a case, you know, somewhere between $20 and $26 a case. And then last, not this past summer, the last year, it was one time, I think the most expensive I had to buy was about $160. So that's for limes, you know.
Because there was such a carryover here, because I remember, like, all of a sudden bars weren't able to stock limes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can't afford it. And then,
yeah, it's like, you know,
then also the quality wasn't always the best because they were held up and, you know, a lot of the farmers couldn't afford. So there was a shortage. So then, you know, I guess... you know, things happen. I don't know the details, but it got back to almost normal.
So that's passed.
And then sometimes you see a little fluctuation, but it hasn't been as bad
as it was.
Yes.
Yeah. So in addition to this company that you run and that you started, mm-hmm. you also run Dough, the yes. donut company, which is a completely separate company.
Yes.
I mean, first of all, that's amazing. So just like, good job.
Thank you.
How do you do this? How do you have two separate, very, very successful and demanding companies?
It's, you know, sometimes I feel completely overwhelmed to the point that I feel paralyzed. Yeah. Like I have so much to do that I can't get going, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So I have to have those moments. I think it's just, but I try not to think about it, and I try to be organized, even though, as you know, it doesn't come naturally.
Do you do both companies every day, or are you like Wednesday is for La Neorquina, you know, yeah. Thursday's for Dough?
So it depends on the time of year. So this past year, because Dough had just opened, I had to spend much more time there. And then at La Neorquina, luckily I have a very good, you know, team that is sort of running on its own. So, but every day, pretty much, you know, I'm doing stuff for La Neorquina, but not there physically, you know, so whether it's emails or, you know, or on the phone with our operations manager or with our chef or creating things. So doing that kind of thing, or saying we have to write recipes to test out. And then physically I'm there once a week. Wednesdays, actually. It's funny enough. And then at Dough, I'm usually there 5 or 6 days a week now, but now I'm also working on the book. So it's not a specific time or day. It's sort of like I go where I'm needed more, but I'm kind of like, I feel like an octopus. I have to
stretch very thin. Stretch
very thin. And so it's hard. I'm not going to say, you know, I don't have it figured out at all. Mm-hmm. And I just try to, you know, build a team and have really good people working with me that I can rely on, but I always say, like, having your own business is kind of like being like a fireman.
And you
fire
have to.
Woman, because you're always putting out fires. Although my dad would just say it's never boring.
Yeah.
And it's true. It's never boring. And I love that.
Yeah. And La Neorquina is so obviously an expression of your heritage. Mm-hmm. Dough, less obvious. And excuse my ignorance, like, but like, are there Mexican donuts?
Are donuts popular in Mexico?
Not the way they are here. I mean, you know, though anything that becomes very popular in New York, I mean, in the States, eventually becomes very popular in Mexico because of the proximity. And but it's not, I mean, we had churros. So that's,
I mean, that's like a donut.
That's like a donut. It's a fried dough.
And with a cart.
And with a cart. Exactly. No, I guess not so obvious in the Mexican heritage way, but in the sense of sort of the pride and the attention to the detail and the sourcing, sort of the philosophy that I have, you know. So like the cinnamon sugar, we use Mexican cinnamon. One of our most popular flavors is our hibiscus donut. So then we do these, I don't know if you guys have tried the Dokas. So it's kind of like a babka, but my version of a babka. So it's made with our donut dough, and it has a chocolate spread, a Belgian chocolate, and then it has Mexican chocolate chunks on top. So that's kind of where my three worlds collide. You know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you could do what you're doing in New York in Mexico? Like you could bring dough to Mexico and it would be well received?
I think now it would. And there's a lot of interest. And it's, you know, Mexico City right now is on fire. And it's very
not
interesting.
Though.
No, no, not literally.
You gotta go put that fire out.
Yes, yes, yes. I think it would. You know, I would probably have different flavors. That, I mean, some of the same flavors, but I would, you know, play around with a lot of things that... you know, that are very local to Mexico, but I think it would be very well received, but in a very different way than it is here. I mean, here it's something you grew up with, you know, and then with the paletas, you know, that's a much more obvious thing, but still I would want to present something different because I don't want to compete with, you know, the people that have been doing it for generations through generation. Like I don't, you know, I don't want to take business away from them. And it's just a different perspective, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. You do, you know, you get to do what you do because they have been doing what
yes,
they're doing.
And, exactly.
And why would you take that away from them?
Exactly.
What's the food scene in Mexico City like right now?
The food scene in Mexico City is very exciting. You know, it's a lot of new places popping up, a lot of... You know, although they have this term, I have to say, I find it really annoying. You know, when you go to a restaurant and say, well, what kind of food are you serving? Or what kind of restaurant is this? They said, oh, it's author's cuisine, you know, cocina de autor. I'm like, what? It's like a chef's, it's the chef's perspective. I'm like, well, yeah, that's kind of implied. That's a chef-driven place. I just find... that a bit,
authors,
you know, yeah. Wow. I don't know, I find that a bit cocky.
Yeah, it's a little but, pretentious sounding.
Yes, but having, you know, labels aside, it's just very exciting. I think that there's a lot of people looking at Mexico City, so, you know, they're in center stage, so people are, you know, kind of feeling very free to express themselves. And there's a lot of chefs taking traditional ingredients or cuisine and having the responsibility or feeling a responsibility of, you know, whether it's the heirloom beans or the heirloom corn to really, but show it in their authoritative mm-hmm. Way. So, and also, you start to see a lot of restaurants with new cuisines that you didn't have. Like one of my best friends, Josefina, who used to live in New York, and she was the chef at Pampano restaurant, which is like an upscale Mexican seafood place. And she has two places in Mexico. One is called Sesame, and it's kind of Asian street food. And the other one is Paprika, and that's more like Arab street food. It's very rare to find those kinds of restaurants in Mexico, mm-hmm. it was until now. And so she's been doing very well, and so that's exciting, you know.
Well, Fanny, I feel like we could talk to you about Mexico forever. We're gonna have to take a break here. We'll be back with the morning after quiz.
If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
And we're back here on The Morning After. So during our interview with Fanny, our fantastic engineer and executive producer, Jack, looked up that horrible restaurant in Pakistan. What did we learn, Jack?
Well, what did we learn? The cafe owner is actually a woman.
No.
Yeah, and her name is Nadia Ali.
Nadia, if you're listening, holler at us. We want to talk to you.
Yes. Get your head straight. Seriously.
Get your head straight.
Things aren't right.
Snap okay. out of it.
All right. Well, now on to something actually fun. Fanny, this is time for the Morning After quiz, okay? So you know all about your donut shop's dough, but what do you know about every kid's favorite thing to secretly eat? Play-Doh.
Nothing.
Great. Okay, fantastic. Good. Point for us already, Sari. So this is three questions, multiple choice.
Are they all about Play-Doh?
All about Play-Doh.
Wow.
All right, so.
I can tell you I've already failed.
I have faith in you, Fanny.
Okay.
I have faith. All right, question one. First manufactured in Cincinnati, Ohio in the 30s, what was Play-Doh's original purpose? Was it A, as a wallpaper cleaner? Was it B, as a type of pest control? Or was it C, a long shelf life bread dough? There's actually flour in Play-Doh, by the way.
Wow. I'm going to go with the plaster.
The wallpaper answer. Cleaner?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
It was used as a wallpaper cleaner, and some kids in like a nursery school were playing with it and making models out of it.
Wow.
Good thing it wasn't toxic. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
All right. Question two.
You know more than you thought.
Exactly.
Yeah, who knew?
What is the name of Play-Doh's mascot? Is it A?
Play-Doh has a mascot?
Play-Doh has a mascot. Is it A, Play-Doh Pete? Is it B, Gooey Gary? Or is it C, Clay Play-Doh?
Wah, wah. That sucks that one of those is true.
Yeah. You know, I would want to say it's B because it's the more fun, but it's not really gooey. So
really
I'm gonna
here.
Go.
I like it.
I'm gonna go with C.
You mean with C, Clay Play-Doh? Yeah. You know, actually, no. It's Play-Doh Pete.
Oh, worst one.
And Play-Doh Pete actually wears a beret or wore
no
a beret
way.
Up until a few years ago. Now he wears a
He's
baseball
French.
Cap. Well,
where is this mascot?
He's on the
traveling?
Play-Doh.
Yeah. That's the best they could come up with.
Well, now he wears a baseball hat. Yeah, I know. Yeah. He's pretty boring.
You're like, I don't know.
Oh. Wow.
All right. Last question.
Okay.
Last year, the Play-Doh Cake Mountain Extruder Tool was recalled for what reason? Is it A, it looked like a syringe? B, pieces were easy for kids to choke on? Or C, it was too phallic?
All of the above.
Wow. Yeah. Is there a D answer? I'm gonna say B.
You're gonna say B, pieces were easy for kids to
yep.
choke on?
Yep. Like a safety thing.
No, it was
C.
No.
It was too phallic. I'll show you a photo.
Oh my god.
What kids are noting
the
that?
Kids aren't noting it. The parents are. I don't know. Actually,
kids.
You know, like an 8-year-old kid might be like, oh.
Parents, get your head on straight.
Honestly, is this a new piece that didn't exist before?
It like apparently you put Play-Doh in it and then it's kind of like a cake piping kind
yeah.
of thing. Like if you make the icing with it and it
this
it
is just
very
about the dirty
phallic.
Parents, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. We can't have nice things anymore because of the parents.
Oh. Wow.
Well, Fanny Gerson of Dough and La New Yorkina, thank you so much for
thank
joining
you guys
us on the
for
morning
having
after.
Me.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.